Fracchia at Pesca. He had a penetrating eye for design, and I asked him to visit Brownie's restaurant with me. Eugene took one look and gave the space a thumbs up. When I came back later by myself, the cashier remembered me. "The owner's here," he said, "and he'd be happy to see you now." Minutes later, out came Sam Brown, a short, balding man who looked to be in his 70s, wearing brown sandals with socks. In a soft voice, he told me he had opened Brownie's, the first vegetarian restaurant in the United States, in 1936. Back then, Union Square was the locus of frequent workers' protests, and vegetarianism was considered a left-wing political movement. A kind man suffering from what sounded like an asthmatic cough, Mr. Brown was planning to retire and told me he was open to discussing a deal. We hit it off and agreed after only our second meeting that I would purchase the last 14 years of Brownie's 20-year lease. Two meetings later, we consummated a deal. To celebrate, Sam, now the former owner of America's oldest vegetarian restaurant, took me to Sparks Steakhouse on East 46th Street. He was a neighbor and friend of Pat Setta, who, with his brother Mike, had founded Sparks in 1966 on East 18th Street. For a decade, I learned, Sam had been sneaking out of his own vegetarian restaurant to splurge on sirloin steak at Sparks. That night at Sparks, Pat Setta sat down with Sam and me for three scintillating hours of steak, storytelling, red wine, and repartee. Somehow, Pat also decided to adopt me as a mentee. He regaled us with stories about getting screwed by restaurant critics and how he'd screwed them back, and stories about his favorite restaurateur, Barry Wine of the Quilted Giraffe, and he swore he would never use any ice cream other than Bassett's from Philadelphia. He took pride in the coarse, dust-free black pepper he served and the magical way his waiters changed their tablecloths between the entree and dessert and in how unbelievably much money he was making selling steak. I hired a construction crew and engaged Warren Ashworth and his boss Larry Bogdanow to design Union Square Cafe. Larry was earthy, cerebral, and intense. Warren was dry, irreverent, and sharp. Each was brimming with imagination and enthusiasm for the project. The two had little experience with restaurants. They spoke of only two very small projects to date, and they reacted politely when I told them that I wanted to design a restaurant that looked as if no architect had ever been there. I suppose I could have picked my favorite trattoria in Rome and instructed Warren and Larry to go there and simply reproduce it in New York. Other restaurateurs have done that brilliantly. Years later, Balthazar in Manhattan's Soho District became such a perfect reproduction of a brasserie that I would almost rather go there than to half a dozen authentic brasseries I know of in Paris. That is an awesome accomplishment, but replicating something already in existence is not where my own business or design sense has ever guided me. Instead, I had asked my architects to create a restaurant that would be easy, comfortable, and timeless, that would look as if it had been there forever. On the occasion of Union Square Cafe's 20th anniversary in 2005, Larry Riley observed, "Now it has been there forever." The combined cost of paying for the assigned lease, the design, and the construction of this 5,000-square-foot restaurant in 1985 was just a little over $700,000, an absurdly gentle figure by today's standards. With my $350,000 of cashed-in checkpoint stock, I still needed to raise an equal additional amount. Even though my family, except, of course, for my uncle Richard Polsky, continued to think I was crazy to be getting into the restaurant business, there was evidently enough loving confidence in me that I managed to raise almost all the additional backing from the family, much of it in the form of loans, allowing me to retain most of the equity. A couple of associates of my grandfather, Irving Harris, helped me to figure out how to put the deal together and also how to explain the investment to various members of my family. Construction began on Memorial Day and was completed in less than 5 months. The experience was a cliffhanger. We had settled on October 21st, 1985 as our opening date, but with 1 week to go, we were still finishing the cherry wood floors and applying wainscoting to the walls. It was impossible to lead any kind of meetings or training sessions amid the noise, smells, and chaos. I conducted all staff interviews on the sidewalk while sitting on a sawhorse next to a dumpster. Intuitively, I was searching for employees with the kind of personal style I'd find compatible with my own. My brain was looking for people with restaurant skills, but my heart was beseeching me to cultivate a restaurant family. The job application form I wrote was idiosyncratic. I typed questions like, "How has your sense of humor been useful to you in your service career? What was so wrong about your last job? Do you prefer Hellman's or Miracle Whip? If you're trying to provide engaging hospitality and outstanding technical service, there must also be a certain amount of fun involved." And those bizarre questions helped give me an idea of whether or not applicants had a sense of humor. They needed one, too, as our training sessions necessarily took place in the middle of Union Square Park. I'd buy a big bushel of Johnny Gold apples, and we would sit on the grass, munch on apples, and play-act service scenarios. One day in the park, I looked over my shoulder to see Brian Miller and the cookbook author Pierre Frenet taking notes on what we were doing. While I was cooking in France, Brian had written to tell me that he had been named Mimi Sheraton's replacement as chief restaurant critic at the New York Times. I wrote back congratulating him and telling him of my concrete plans to open a restaurant in New York. Upon my return in January 1985, we dined out together just once, but the dinner proved very uncomfortable for each of us. The restaurant that Brian had picked to review that night was La Caravelle, whose new chef was my former colleague at Pesca, Michael Romano. I felt uneasy to be surreptitiously complicit in the judgment of my friend's cooking, and I felt unscrupulous to be a future restaurateur dining with the current restaurant critic of the New York Times. Though Brian and I had become good friends, we agreed that night not to speak for a long while and to cease dining out altogether. I was beginning to feel the heat. I didn't hire the opening chef for Union Square Cafe until well after I had signed the deal for Brownies. Though I had already decided against it, on some level I was still flirting with the fantasy of being my own chef. Months before, Brian had introduced me to a robust Frenchman named Marc Sarrazin, the top meat purveyor to French restaurants in New York, who also served as an unofficial headhunter for restaurants and an advisor to the city's top culinary talent. Marc knew all the chefs, especially in the French houses. He visited them in their kitchens and knew which talented young cooks were interested in making a move. Marc also knew where the job openings were. He was a rainmaker, and so I asked him to help me find a chef. Within days, he introduced me to a young, baby-faced fish cook named Ali Barker. Ali had been the saucier and chef poissonnier at La Côte Basque, which at the time was a great training ground for a number of promising young chefs, including Todd English and Charlie Palmer. I was also interested in two sous chefs, Scott Campbell, a young cook recommended by a culinary teacher named Peter Kump, who I had also met through Brian, and Marcy Smith, a cook at Barry and Susan Wine's four-star quilted giraffe. I arranged tasting auditions in the kitchen of my apartment on East 84th Street. Taking a page from the outdoor cooking contest I had competed in at camp as a 12-year-old, I gave each cook a chicken breast, some butter, an onion, garlic, fresh herbs, and a tomato to see what he or she would do with them. Ollie's chicken was juicy and seasoned just properly. Impressively, he subsequently used the chicken bones and onion to make a delicious stock. When I hired him as executive chef, we agreed that he would give the job 2 years, which was acceptable to me since it was about as far into the future as I could see anyway. Staffing was a study in the blind leading the blind. I hired a chef who had never been a chef or sous chef, and who was even younger than I was. Naively, I made myself the opening general manager, responsible for things I knew little or nothing about, like setting the staff's schedule, overseeing repairs and maintenance, and conducting performance reviews. I had lured Gordon Dudash from Pesca to be my second in command as manager, but he had managed only an inanimate bar before, never a live staff. Our bookkeeper was an incredibly nice man, with no previous bookkeeping experience, and one of our waiters surprised me during our 2 days of training by insisting on opening a bottle of champagne with a corkscrew. On the evening of October 20th, 1985, we served our opening night party. It was a numbing, surreal moment, and an emotionally loaded night for me. I broke into tears as soon as the doors flew open, realizing that this moment marked the culmination of a lot of professional research, as well as a lifetime of personal development. 75 people showed up, all of them friends or family members. There was something bittersweet in the air as well. My dad was not present. He apparently had gone on a business trip. Were my tears in part about his not being there? Or were they because I now knew that I didn't need him to be there? In any case, this was my moment to achieve something on my own. I had spent nearly 2 years doing my best work ever as a student, and now it was up to me to show what I had learned and what I was capable of doing on my own 2 feet. However the restaurant might ultimately fare, this opening night was a breakthrough in my career and in my life. These were tears of intense joy and sadness, relief and release. During those first weeks and months, it didn't take me long to learn that very little makes guests matter than having to wait for the reserved table or food. That was happening a lot because the phone was ringing with increasing frequency, and I was saying yes to almost every request for a reservation. Though the restaurateur in me was obsessed with hospitality, the entrepreneur in me was becoming addicted to volume. I was always trying to see how many covers, customers in restaurant parlance, we could serve on a given day. This was also important since a higher volume meant more tips for the servers. I could not afford to lose the few good servers we had, but I would lose them if they weren't able to make a living wage. The restaurant had 135 seats, and each night my goal was to set a new personal best for covers. We were consistently hovering around the one-turn mark, seating each table just once per night, and we had plateaued at around 140 for several weeks. Then, I almost brought the kitchen and restaurant down one night when we shattered our record and served 171 guests. Each high watermark led to another. I charted out a manual reservation system assigning 2 hours for each deuce, an additional 30 minutes for each foretop, and 3 hours for a party of five or more. This was clearly maximizing covers, but I did not yet understand the art of pacing tables. The problem was that with a kitchen as undersized as ours, seating more than 20 or so guests every 15 minutes would invariably clog it up. It was like shoving too much mass down the tube part of a funnel, stopping the flow of food altogether. On the first night that we served actual paying guests, two parties left because their food never arrived. In the weeks going forward, excruciating waits and walkouts were the norm more than the exception. We realized that the broad number of items on the menu was far too ambitious for our small kitchen and our inexperienced cooks. I hated having to edit dishes I loved from the menu, even if only temporarily, but I did remove them. On most nights, there would come a point when I would leave the dining room and stand sweating in the kitchen because I couldn't face the fuming guests anymore. Watching Ali try to expedite his way out of a wall of dupes, or guest checks, each one representing a table of hungry guests, was safer than subjecting myself to the slings and arrows in the dining room. In my obsession for big numbers, I'd created hideous log jams, but it was oddly exciting to manufacture challenges and then surmount them. In fact, that was and continues to be a pattern in the way I work. I drew up new reservation sheets, adjusted the seating chart, reassigned waiter stations, and sharpened my calculations of the turn time for each table, all with the goal of maximizing volume without compromising our ability to deliver excellence. As a puzzle, this was both an art and a science, and each dinner service brought new opportunities to make adjustments in pace, flow, and progress. I was developing what I would call an athletic approach to hospitality, sometimes playing offense, sometimes playing defense, but always wanting to find a way to win. On offense, we would figure out creative ways to enhance an already good experience. Extra desserts with inscriptions written in chocolate for birthdays, dessert wine for regulars. Playing defense, we got better and better at overcoming our frequent mistakes or at diffusing whatever situations the guests might be angry about. Increasingly, their anger was over not getting a reservation at a specific time. I was good at dealing with that, guided by my instinct to let the callers know I was on their side. "I'd love to put your name at the top of our wait list for 8 o'clock," I would say. Or, "There are literally no tables at 8. Is there any way I could do this for you at 8:45? Which I knew sounded a little earlier than 9:15. Or, Can you give me a range that would work for you so that I can root for a cancellation? The point was to keep the dialogue open while sending the message, I'm your agent, not the gatekeeper. For those who had to wait too long, there was often a reward, a generous supply of dessert wines on the house. We had resuscitated an old refrigerator from Brownies in the back bar that we named the medicine cabinet, the medicine being our ample collection of dessert wines, which we dispensed liberally by the glass as an apology to guests. Except for the most hostile, the medicine generally worked. Back in 1985, one rarely saw dessert wines by the glass on a menu in New York. This was still much more of a European custom. But I began offering an extensive list of dessert wines by the glass. It was an important early lesson in applying defensive hospitality when things don't go according to plan. Guests began coming back and asking for dessert wine. And now they were paying for it. Those early days were filled with unexpected lessons in management. I recall the Friday after Thanksgiving, just 5 weeks after opening. Business had been decent, but we hadn't yet been reviewed, and I had anticipated a very slow holiday weekend. I gave both Chef Ali and his sous chef and girlfriend Marcy Smith the weekend off so they could go to Pepper Pike, Ohio, where Ali would be presented to Marcy's parents, his future in-laws. My prediction of a slow weekend was absolutely wrong, and on Friday night, overcome with a slew of last-minute reservations, we were so busy that I needed to throw on kitchen whites over my suit and tie and cook. The kitchen was swamped, and guests were waiting 30 minutes for their appetizers and at least that long for their main courses. I was overheated, and my red Brooks Brothers tie began bleeding all over my wrinkled white button-down shirt. I became lightheaded, not having bothered to eat all day. At one point, I walked out of the kitchen into the dining room and saw a drunken patron stumbling around, loudly ranting about not being able to order a baked potato at this crappy restaurant. My judgment was cloudy from fatigue and hunger, and I chose to confront the man on his own terms. When I told him we wouldn't serve him another drop of anything, he blurted, "You can't cut me off." "Yes, I can," I replied. "Your check is on the way." "You can't make me pay my check," he countered. "Maybe not," I said, "but I can tell you to leave my restaurant." We continued our conversation, frayed not, frayed so, while dancing chest to chest through the dining room and then up the stairs toward the bar. As we neared the front door, he threw a nasty punch that hit me squarely in the jaw. I punched him back as hard as I could. I then managed to push him toward the door and out into the vestibule, but from there he was able to grab the door handle and next my head, which he slammed between the door and the door jamb. That was painful, and when he began to come at me again, I instinctively wound up and kicked him as hard as I possibly could right in the nuts. He managed to crouch his way outside to the sidewalk on East 16th Street, where his two dining companions, who had been lurking around uselessly during the altercation, finally picked him up off the sidewalk and stuffed him into a taxi. The next week, I opened the Daily News and learned for the first time that its restaurant critic Arthur Schwartz had been in the restaurant that raucous evening and had witnessed the entire fracas. Remarkably, he omitted any mention of the fisticuffs in his review, but he later told me he had seen the whole thing. He hoped I was feeling better. Schwartz became the first critic in New York to suggest that Union Square Cafe had tremendous promise and that we were doing something groundbreaking and fresh. His review was the first to put us on the map. Meanwhile, I was looking over my shoulder for Brian Miller. Brian was now the most powerful restaurant critic in America, and since we had a tacit agreement not to be in contact, I had no idea when or even if he'd ever show up in our dining room. It was crucial for me that Union Square Cafe express a sense of boldness and innovation. I wanted to blend the best of European fine dining with the ease and comfort of American style. I imagined Union Square Cafe as a combination of three very different kinds of restaurants one encountered in the late 1970s. First, the earthy, seasonal, local food-loving places in Berkeley and San Francisco. Second, the refined gastronomic temples of Paris. And third, the mama and papa trattorias of Rome. I was determined to find a way to emulsify those three ingredients to create an ambience of relaxed excellence. I was convinced that I could blend the best of California, Paris, and Rome and have it all ways. Refined technical service paired with caring, gracious hospitality and soulful seasonal cooking. Going against the grain of the high-flying 1980s, we always looked for low-key, straightforward ways to celebrate with the guests in our dining room. One easy way to set ourselves apart in that era, when lofty menu tabs convolutedly conferred superior status, was to offer exceptional value. I was willing to accept legitimate criticism for any aspect of the restaurant, but if anyone ever accused us of overcharging for our product, I was mortified. My views on this had been shaped by my own early experiences at restaurants with my family, when I had been urged to read the menu from right to left, that is, prices first. My dining forays in Italy and France in my early 20s had also shaped my ideas. The dollar had been very strong back then, and I was used to downing appetizer bowls of the world's best pasta for, say, $3 or $4. I was appalled that in America some restaurants were now charging $18 for entree portions of only passable pasta. And I saw offering value as a great opportunity to distinguish us from the rest of the pack. But it was in the late 1980s, several years after Union Square Cafe had opened, that I had my epiphany as a restaurateur. Audrey and I were in Paris making our first visit to the three-star Taillevant. The seamless service and exquisite hospitality were superior to anything I had ever experienced, and the polished staff members also possessed a confident sense of humor about themselves while providing pleasure for the guest. This was the first time I had ever dined at a Michelin three-star restaurant that, in addition to serving ethereally good food, was actually fun. It is no coincidence the Taillevant has maintained its three-star rating for more than three decades. If there's a better restaurateur in the world than Taillevant Jean-Claude Vrinot, whose father created the restaurant, I have yet to meet him or her. Self-deprecating to a fault, Monsieur Vrinot brushed off my gratitude for an evening of perfect service. "We have fun taking service seriously," he said. "And as for perfection, we just hide our mistakes better than anyone else." That was a refreshing insight for me as I continued to hone my own version of hospitality. The most significant and lasting way for our restaurant to set itself apart was the way we defined and delivered hospitality. Union Square Cafe opened in 1985 during the first blast of the Masters of the Universe culture. There was a combination of abundant money floating around and a lingering effect of the velvet rope at Studio 54. The more expensive or exclusive something was, the more coveted it became. I don't remember ever having particularly enjoyed a place just because I'd been afraid that it wouldn't have me, so I was appalled to think that by charging people too much money and putting up barriers to entry, some restaurants had actually created an inflated demand to be part of their scene. Those candles had short wicks. The discos of the 1970s had given way to the coked-up nightclubs of the early 1980s, which in turn gave way to stadium-sized restaurants where the food was actually really nothing more than a prop in an ersatz nightclub scene. This was happening a lot, particularly as people started to gravitate downtown and take over lofty warehouse-like spaces. At the other extreme of the dining culture were celebratory, serious French restaurants, such as La Grenouille, Le Cirque, La Côte Basque, and Lutèce. What you didn't see much of was excellent dining in a setting of down-to-earth comfort. I sensed that there was in New York a community of food lovers who would be happy to be welcomed warmly and charged fair prices. In fact, conceiving Union Square Cafe as an excellent version of a neighborhood restaurant was, in retrospect, not very challenging. It turned out that there was a tremendous gap in the dining culture that allowed us to open in a comparatively uncrowded field. We were doing something new and unexpected, and it was attracting an intelligent, self-confident clientele. Understanding the distinction between service and hospitality has been at the foundation of our success. Service is the technical delivery of a product. Hospitality is how the delivery of that product makes its recipient feel. Service is a monologue. We decide how we want to do things, and we set our own standards for service. Hospitality, on the other hand, is a dialogue. To be on a guest's side requires listening to that person with every sense and following up with a thoughtful, gracious, appropriate response. It takes both great service and great hospitality to rise to the top. When you are seated at the precise time of your reservation, at the exact table, and with the waiter you requested, that's a reflection of good service. When the right food is delivered to the right person at the right table at the right temperature at the right time, that's service. When you see a member of the waitstaff decanting a bottle of wine with care and grace, that's service. When your empty plate is cleared from the table in a graceful manner, that too is service. When, in answer to your question, the waiter can explain the nuances of the wines on our list, that's service. But hospitality, which most distinguishes our restaurants, and ultimately any business, is the sum of all the thoughtful, caring, gracious things our staff does to make you feel we are on your side when you're dining with us. In the first 3 months we were open, I left Union Square Cafe just one night to celebrate Audrey's birthday with a dinner uptown at the 4-star Lutèce. It was our first grown-up restaurant date in months. I didn't go out for a long time after that. I was fairly certain that Brian Miller of the Times was going to come in to review us one night, and I absolutely wanted to be there when that happened. We were beginning to build a nice business, already serving more guests than I had ever imagined, learning to do it just a little better every day. Over the next month, Brian at last came in 5 times for 2 lunches and 3 dinners. I was there every time. One night I knew I should expect him because although he had made the reservation under a new alias, he had used the same callback number as on a previous visit. I remembered from the wine class we took together that he hated overchilled wines. I tried to guess what he would select in advance because our bar refrigerator was malfunctioning, nearly freezing the bottles of wine. Knowing his taste, I predicted that he would choose to begin with a white Italian. I even remembered which Italian white wines were his favorites. 5 minutes before Brian's expected arrival, I pulled 5 bottles from the refrigerator so that they would be less cold by the time he ordered. He did come, and just as I'd expected, he turned to the selection of Italian whites on the wine list. But when the waiter sent in his order, I was terrified to see that Brian had not picked any one of the 5 wines I had pre-selected. He had ordered one that was still in the freezing refrigerator, a Tokaj Friulano from Ronco del Niemiec, and the bottle was frosty. Cursing under my breath, I went over to the bar well out of sight of his table and stuck the icy bottle of Tokaj between my thighs to warm it up. 5 minutes later, Brian's waiter approached me nervously. "Where's the Tokaj? He's asking where it is." Feeling the bottle, I said, "I think it's ready now," and I handed it over. My pants were wet and very cold. A minute later, the waiter returned to the bar with a defeated look, grasping the bottle. "Mr. Miller wants another bottle of Tokaj. This one's too warm." On the night of January 23, 1986, my chef, Ali Barker, and I camped out at the New York Times building on West 43rd Street. At precisely 11:04 p.m., stacks of the next day's early edition papers were tossed from a truck and then unbundled in the lobby. We noticed a few other people waiting for the paper, some who wanted the first crack at the classified one ads, and others whose plays were being reviewed. Plunking down 35 cents, we tore through the paper to the back of the Friday weekend section to find the review of Union Square Cafe. Brian had given us 2 stars. Very good. We were beyond ecstatic. 2 stars really did mean very good in those days, and it read like a money review. He praised the food and the decor, calling them genuine and eclectic, and he said that the seafood risotto was rousing, the spaghetti alla puttanesca generous and boldly seasoned, and so on. 2 of Brian's observations really hit home. The first was that we were fast becoming a lunch haunt for the downtown publishing crowd. To this day, I always want any new restaurant I open to become a lunch haunt for some core group of loyal customers. To the degree that a restaurant can serve as an unofficial club for any constituency, it takes on an additional mystique that leads to more and more business. Second, Brian wrote that the sensitive design made Union Square Cafe feel like part of the neighborhood, not something imposed on it. Reading his words helped me understand that what I was doing intuitively was actually working. I have made that an intentional strategy for every single restaurant I've opened since. That first review in the New York Times had more revenue impact on Union Square Cafe than any subsequent review has ever had on any of our restaurants. Business spiked 60% overnight. In later years, Brian confided that because of our friendship, he had actually been tougher on us than he might otherwise have been, to avoid any appearance of a conflict of interest. Our third full year, 1988, brought important transitions. For the first time, we broke into the Zagat Surveys list of New York's top 40 favorite restaurants. We were number 21, and Union Square Cafe was described as a triumph of imaginative American cookery. In August 1988, after having been together for 4 years, Audrey and I got married. And by early fall, I made a long-considered change in the kitchen. Ollie Barker, having promised me 2 years at his first job as chef, had now given me 3. He had achieved everything he could for himself, including finding a wonderful woman to be his wife, and had contributed every ounce of raw culinary ability and effort he could muster, despite having no previous experience as a chef. We had an honest and open conversation about the future. I told him, "You have too much potential not to go and learn some more, and Union Square Cafe has too much potential not to benefit from having an even more experienced leader in the kitchen." I urged him to spend some time cooking in France. The discussion was painful and tearful for both of us. We had become good friends and together had injected heart and soul into the place. Though Ali understood exactly what I was saying, it wasn't easy for him to welcome my conclusion. But I knew this was the right decision. Today, many years later, we remain friendly, and he has built a successful restaurant career and meaningful life with his family in the town of St. Joseph, Michigan, on the eastern shore of Lake Michigan. In early October, I hired my old colleague Michael Romano, who had been turning heads at La Caravelle with his solid yet light approach to the French classics. It had taken me a long time to persuade Michael that he should consider making a move downtown, and even longer to get him to say yes. Ultimately, what sold him was the allure of cooking in a restaurant that would let him return to his Italian roots, even if it meant moving away from the refinement he had so diligently achieved as he built his career. In May 1989, Brian Miller returned to review the restaurant once again, this time awarding it 3 stars and calling Union Square Cafe a paragon of a new breed of restaurants that might be called international bistros. Mentioning Michael's passion for Northern Italian cooking, Brian described our menu as the best roster of dishes I've encountered here and reasonably priced as well. Our wine list, he wrote, was one of the city's best, many uncommon treasures. Our tables, he said, were spaced well to allow easy conversation, and the dining room down a few steps off the bar area felt inviting and countryfied. In October, Zagat promoted us from number 21 to number 13 on the list of New York's favorite restaurants. Crushingly, 1989 was also the year that our beloved general manager, Gordon Dudash, succumbed to complications from AIDS. He had hung on just long enough to see the fruits of his labor, a restaurant that was increasingly adored as much for its welcome as for its cooking. I was just 4 years into the restaurant business, and the fire inside me was only beginning to burn. My vision for Union Square Cafe was being realized, from its cozy decor and ambience to the outstanding value we offered. To this day, Union Square Cafe remains the purest expression of me and most clearly represents the mission of all my restaurants: to express excellence in the most inclusive, accessible, genuine, and hospitable way possible. It's human nature for people to take precisely as much interest in you as they believe you're taking in them. There's no stronger way to build relationships than taking a genuine interest in other human beings and allowing them to share their stories. When we take an active interest in the guests at our restaurants, we create a sense of community and a feeling of shared ownership. Shared ownership develops when guests talk about a restaurant as if it's theirs. They can't wait to share it with friends, and what they're really sharing, beyond the culinary experience, is the experience of feeling important, loved, and belonging. That sense of affiliation builds trust and a sense of being accepted and appreciated, invariably leading to repeat business, a necessity for any company's long-term survival. I'm constantly reminding our staff members to initiate a relationship with our guests whenever it's appropriate. For example, It's amazing how powerful it can be simply to ask a guest where they're from. Often that leads to making a connection because we know someone in common, or we've enjoyed the same restaurant, or we can share a sports story. The old game of "Do you know so-and-so?" is a classic example of how to further human connection. And it works. When you're considering several restaurants for dinner, other things being equal, you'll choose the one whose maitre d' went to the same school as you, or who roots for your sports team, or who has the same birthday as you, or knows your second cousin. You'll also tend to choose a restaurant whose chef came out to greet you on your last visit, or who saved you the last soft-shell crab special, knowing it was a favorite of yours. The information is always there if it matters enough to look for it. Making my rounds in the dining room involves, more than anything else, my ability to see, hear, and sense what's going on, so that I can connect intelligently with our staff and guests and make things happen. I don't have a standard approach for every table, but I often start with a gut sense that a patron is ready for a visit. That's what springs me into action. I might just walk over to a table and say, "Thanks for being here." That puts the ball in the other court. The encounter either does or doesn't advance from there. But once a dialogue begins, I start to learn something, and I always act on what I learn. And sometimes I learn that the person just wants to be left alone to eat dinner. One night in April 2002, soon after opening our barbecue restaurant Blue Smoke, I noticed a couple in the back room gazing out at the trees in the courtyard. I could sense that they were debating whether they liked their ribs, so I went over to greet them. "Where are you from?" I asked. "We're from Kansas City," the man said. "We're going to have a tough time living up to the barbecue standards of your hometown," I replied. As we chatted, I also learned that they had recently moved to New York and that they were very happy to have discovered a real pit barbecue place in their own neighborhood. "I only wish we didn't have to make reservations for barbecue 4 weeks in advance," the man said. I told him we had just decided to leave half the tables open for walk-ins as a way of encouraging spontaneous visits to the restaurant. That news pleased them, and then the man added, "You know, in Kansas City they give you more than one kind of sauce. Would you ever consider serving a sweeter and spicier sauce than this?" My hunch was right. Something had been on their minds, and now I knew what it was, and also how to make a connection. "It's interesting to hear you say that, because we're actually working on a Kansas City-style sauce right now in the kitchen. Would you like to be the first guest to try it?" I went to the kitchen for a pitcher of that sauce and brought it back out to the table. The man poured some on his brisket, something a Texan would never do. "This," he said, beaming, "takes me home." I asked for his business card and later wrote him a note when Blue Smoke began offering Kansas City-style barbecue sauce. I'm certain that this couple felt a sense of ownership in the restaurant after our encounter. As far as they were concerned, they were in part responsible for our putting the new sauce on the table. That's the kind of dialogue we want to have. Hospitality can exist only where there is human dialogue. This particular dialogue provided great customer feedback and helped us forge a bond with two customers. Not a bad investment for 6 minutes of my time. I try to be in the restaurants as often as possible. For nearly 20 years until the opening of the Modern on West 53rd Street, all my restaurants were within a 10-minute walk of one another in my apartment, and I made it my business to visit every one of them during lunch. I'm not there just to greet and shake hands. I'm building daily communities within the restaurant's larger community. The best way I do this is to first gather as much information as I can about our guests. I call this collecting dots. In fact, I urge our managers to ABCD, always be collecting dots. Dots are information. The more information you collect, the more frequently you can make meaningful connections that can make other people feel good and give you an edge in business. Using whatever information I've collected to gather guests together in a spirit of shared experience is what I called connecting the dots. If I don't investigate everything I can, I won't see the dots. If I don't collect the dots, I can't connect the dots. If I don't know that someone works, say, for a magazine whose managing editor I happen to know, I've lost a chance to make a meaningful connection that could enhance our relationship with the guest and the guest's relationship with us. The information's there. You just have to choose to look. I always try to sense opportunities to glean information, and it's not limited to information about our guests. I will often just stand on the periphery of the dining room and watch. I gauge the temperature of the room, the smell, the noise. Most important, I watch my staff members. Are they enjoying one another's company? And are they focused on their work? If the answer to both questions is yes, I feel confident that we're at the top of our game. Think about every time you've walked into a restaurant or an office or even looked into the dugout at a baseball game. When the team is having fun and is focused, the chances are very good that that team will win. I study the faces of our guests. If I see that the direction of their eyes intersects at the center of the table, I know that they're actively engaged with one another, and I'm confident that everything is fine. This is an inopportune time to visit. Guests dine out primarily to be with one another, and their eyes tell me that they're doing precisely what they came to do. Whenever I see that the direction of someone's eyes is not bisecting the center of the table, then a visit might be warranted. I'm not certain that something's wrong, but I am certain that there's an opportunity to make a connection without feeling like an intruder. It could be that a guest has been waiting too long for his or her food and is looking for a waiter. Or it could be that someone's simply curious about the architecture, a work of art on the wall, or for that matter, an attractive guest across the dining room. A guest could be momentarily bored or just taking a pause, or having a fight with a companion. A little perception goes a long way. Hospitality can, in the right instance, involve little more than standing nearby and allowing my body language to smile at the guests. If I catch, say, a woman's eye, she may beckon me to the table and let me know that she needs water, a waiter, or the check. If I thank her for coming to the restaurant, she might then say, "You're very welcome. This place is so much better than your other restaurants." Or, "We were wondering when you opened this restaurant." Or, "It's nice to be back. It's gotten much better. Last time the service was slow." Or, "We hadn't been back since you opened. It was so loud then. How'd you fix that?" In these exchanges, I'm collecting information not just about who our guests are, but about how they feel about our product. One advantage a restaurant has over many other businesses is that we can get instant feedback while our consumers are consuming our product. People have an emotional attachment to food and to their money, and they come to our restaurants with high expectations. To the degree that they believe we are on their side, we usually don't have to work very hard to get candid reactions. If our customers love what they've ordered, I can tell by looking at their faces and their plates. If they aren't happy, they're going to let me or my staff know, as long as we've built the right relationship with them. One night in Blue Smoke, I noticed that some diners had finished eating but had left most of their onion rings untouched on the plate. They could simply have been full, but I went over to say hi and to have a closer look. Sure enough, the rings didn't look very crispy. "You didn't love them," I said, gesturing to the rings. "You know, you're right," the man answered. "They were the only thing I thought could have been better. I wish they'd been crispier and spicier." "Well then," I said, "you're not paying for them." A moment later, as they got up to leave, the man handed me a $100 bill. "This is for the waiter," he said. Good as this waiter was, I knew that the generous gratuity was in part a reflection of the fact that the guests appreciated our taking a special interest in them and caring for them. In the end, we decided to take the onion rings off the menu altogether because we couldn't get them consistently right without incurring a very high labor cost to produce them. That, of course, led to a spate of new complaints. "Bring back the onion rings!" If I see a new area code or zip code on our reservations list, or if I notice that some guests came from as far away as, for instance, St. Paul, Minnesota, Highland Park, Illinois, or Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'll make sure that these guests get special attention. We might ask them how they heard about us. We might ask them if they're in town on business or a vacation. We will ask where else they'll be dining while they're in New York. That opens a dialogue with them as well as an opportunity to send them to one of our other restaurants where they can expect to get another special welcome. The hope is that when they return home, they'll spread the word about each of our restaurants. How do you get customers to come back for more? That's the question facing every business owner, whether the business is a bowling alley, a pharmacy, computer company, or a tattoo parlor. There are two processes at work, trial and repeat, and it's critically important to prevail in each of them. If you own a restaurant and you're fortunate enough to persuade someone to give it an initial try, which is no small feat, you'd better make a great impression and win the first round. I think that most businesses are better at coddling regulars than they are at focusing on first-timers, but both are crucial to any business. Although it's obviously important to keep your steady clientele happy, life depends on auspicious beginnings. In tennis, you can't possibly win a tournament without first having won each of the earlier rounds. If we can get to the third round with a guest, we've got a good shot at moving him or her into the important group of patrons who become cherished regulars. Our batting average is pretty good. I'd guess we succeed in earning repeat business over 70% of the time. It's significant that the older our businesses become, the more popular they become, and not just according to the Zagat survey. With few exceptions, our restaurants have also enjoyed increased revenues each successive year they've been open. I know that popularity is not in and of itself a measure of excellence, but it is one reliable measure of how many people you're pleasing and how well you're pleasing them. My goal is to earn regular, repeat patronage from a large number of people, 40% of our lunch business and 25% of our nightly business, who will dine at our restaurants 6 to 12 times a year. Unlike a Broadway show, which most people will see just once, no matter how much they've enjoyed it, a solid restaurant experience should make you want to return for more. There are always more dishes to sample, more waiters by whom to be served, and more tables from which to view the ever-changing scene. At its best, a restaurant should not let guests leave without feeling as though they've been satisfyingly hugged. If you can do that, regardless of what product you're offering, you've built a solid foundation for your business. Those satisfied customers become not just your regulars, but also your apostles. They'll proceed to sell your product for you by telling the whole world how much they like it. Automobile companies and watchmakers have long understood that people buy their products not just because of how the product itself performs, but to tell a story about themselves. Almost any watch tells time. Every car can get you from point A to point B, and every restaurant can feed you. Just as my choice of a watch to wear and a car to drive, and be seen driving, says something about me, so too does my choice of where I dine frequently. We want as many of our guests as possible to be proud to identify themselves with our restaurants. Our job is to give people a story worth telling. For us, building a community of regulars has become more efficient with computers and online reservations than it was in our early days when we maintained a standard paper and pencil reservation book. I receive computer-generated copies of the detailed reservation sheets from each of our restaurants first thing every day. My assistant also reviews the sheets in the morning, looking for tidbits of information that can help us offer our guests more hospitality. Knowing who is dining where and when helps me determine how to plan and plot out my day. It also gives me the opportunity to get involved with seating and greeting plans. We look for opportunities to create chance encounters by strategically seating people with similar business interests near one another. We also try to create privacy for those who want it. I happen to love maps. I view our reservationists as cartographers, the reservation sheets as a map, and the dining experience as a brief vacation for our guests. As with any trip, there are lots of routes one can take, and it's our job to draw a map with the greatest possible detail. The more specific information we can gather ahead of someone's dining experience, the greater the chance that we can create a rave experience. Is it a special occasion? A first visit? Does this guest prefer a quiet table? Was there any problem the last time the guest visited? Does any guest have an allergy? This guest loves red wine. That guest is a columnist for Newsweek. Another's going to a Knicks game. And so on. Our telephone reservationists, who are our first line of offense in delivering hospitality, listen carefully and then input whatever data they receive from a caller into our open table reservation and guest notes database. In the old days, we'd also gather information, but it was simply written in pencil on the reservation sheet for the day. That system made it unlikely that we would ever be able to retrieve the information again. This information tells our hosts, maitre d', managers, and servers a lot about a guest's needs and helps us to customize our service and hospitality. We also make sure to enter into customer notes any previous mistakes we made. Overcooked salmon on July 16th, spilled wine on purse on May 12th. We also indicate all special requests. Likes table 42. Bring hot sauce with the food. Loves the corner table. Ice on side always with cocktails. Allergic to shellfish. Serve coffee after dessert. Which then show up on our computer reservation screen. As long as we make it clear that we're interested in knowing through active listening, most people are delighted to tell us exactly what they want or need. When a reservation indicates that a guest is dining at one of our restaurants for the first time, We'll make sure the host knows. If we're to stand any chance of creating a new regular, it all starts here. We will need to win that trial round. In the late 1990s, when I first started hearing about web-based electronic reservation books, I was very resistant to the whole notion. I thought that by taking online reservations, we would be losing the advantage we had always had with our warm human telephone staff. We would be like every other restaurant. But then I changed my view for one reason. To close that window of access to people who preferred making their reservations online would be poor hospitality. It may be more convenient for them to reserve at 11:30 at night when they're sitting at their computers than during our regular business hours. It will let them check out the availability of a table without making a single call, without the frustration of a busy signal, without being put on hold, and without eventually being told that there's nothing available. Once I finally accepted the inevitability of online reservations, I fell in love with the process and its benefits. Every time somebody makes a reservation on the internet, that's one less telephone call for a reservationist to handle. As a result, the reservationist can more often avoid making the annoying request, "May I put you on hold while I take another call?" The information we receive, whether a booking was made by telephone or on the internet, is instantly added to the file of guest preferences that we once recorded manually on reservation sheets or occasionally on file cards. And now, thanks to the vast record-keeping capacity of the computer, I can measure the degree to which guests are regulars. I can know what their favorite table is or if they have a favorite or least favorite server. I can know when a guest's birthday or anniversary is. I can know if guests are regulars at our other restaurants, in which case I'm even more pleased to see them coming in to try another one of our restaurants for the first time. All this adds up to a goldmine of information, which allows us to connect all sorts of dots. Despite high-tech enhancements, restaurants will always remain a hands-on, high-touch, people-oriented business. Nothing will ever replace shaking people's hands, smiling, and looking them in the eye as a genuine means of welcoming them. And that is why hospitality, unlike widgets, is not something you can stamp out on an assembly line. But its powerful impact can be taught, and teaching it with hundreds of colleagues is the best way I've found to extend my reach. One reality of our business growth is that I cannot be everywhere at all times. I compensate for the fact that there's only one of me by studying the maps and responding. I'll often run into somebody on the street and be able to say, "I understand you were at Tabla last night. How was your dinner?" People immediately feel good and are surprised that I would know this. But why wouldn't I? If I want our guests to take an interest in us, I'd better take an equal interest in them. My wife Audrey, an experienced mother of four children, has remarked that watching me in the process of creating a new restaurant reminds her of what she goes through becoming and being a mom. Like restaurants, kids are a lot of fun to conceive and significantly less fun to gestate over the next 9 months. You don't get much sleep for the first 6 months after they arrive, and you feel as if you're never going to get your nose above water. Then, if you're really lucky, after about a year, they start to pay lifelong dividends. And we are willing to do it all over again only because we have built-in memory erasers that allow us to forget how painful the whole process was in the first place. My ultimate mission for any new restaurant is always to begin with a subject I love, zero in on what I enjoy most about it, and then envision a new context for it. I take something that is already accessible, such as frozen custard, and try to make it better, or I take what's excellent, a selection of artisanal cheeses or a wine list, and try to present it in a more user-friendly context. I'm never out to invent a new cuisine. Instead, I'm interested in creating a fresh hybrid dining experience. And then, like a museum curator, I strive to put a complementary frame around it, finding the right wall to hang it on, and aim just the proper lighting on it. The care with which we design our restaurants and the thoughtful way our chefs create the food on our menus are two elements that add significantly to the artistry and the handcrafted feel of a new restaurant. I feel the entrepreneurial spark when some instinct tells me that a certain dining context does not currently exist, but should exist. I then ask myself a series of questions that force me to examine and challenge the status quo, and then change it. Each question begins with these five words: "Who ever wrote the rule?" Whoever wrote the rule, for example, that you shouldn't be able to enjoy a refined dining experience with the finest ingredients served on Limoges china in a rustic tavern? Or that you can't serve slow-smoked pulled pork with a glass of champagne or Chianti Classico just off Park Avenue? Or that you can't create a classic burger and shakes drive-in in New York City where nobody drives? Each venture has taken shape differently. It could be that I know of a chef I really want to work with and now must search for an idea and a location, Gramercy Tavern. Or I could have what I think is a compelling idea and then look for a location and a chef, Union Square Cafe. Or I could be in love with a specific location and need to find the chef and the idea, the Modern. Context is everything. What has guided me most as an entrepreneur is the confluence of passion and opportunity, and sometimes serendipity, that leads to the right context for the right idea at the right time, in the right place, and for the right value. I have never relied on or been interested in market analysis.